So, Brian, where's Brian? Thank you so much. Hello, Brian. Thank you for inviting me. I know you were expecting a bit of comic relief as we wrap up the conference today, so I hope I don't disappoint. Renee, where's Renee? Renee, thank you for being so welcoming. And to your compatriots here, some of whom I haven't met yet, yes, my family name is Dutch. Yes, I am of Dutch heritage. English too, but we're, okay, whatever. In 1810, my father's paternal ancestors emigrated from the island of Texel to the island of Manhattan. Step up, right? Okay. In fact, I still have the shoes they wore when they walked from island to island at low tide in the North Sea. This is over 200 years old. So, but I have one request which I will try in Dutch. Alsjeblieft, geen vrezen hebben tot na mijn vertrek. Is that good? Okay, thank you for the applause. I'm sure it was terrible. For the English, it is please no Frisian jokes until after I leave. I've been told we might not be Frisian, but play along with me anyhow. So this afternoon, I'm here as a corporate speechwriter, entrepreneur, and the American guy, right? But perhaps my most important role is as an adjunct professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs in New York City, affectionately known as CIPA. I mention CIPA because CIPA frames my remarks today. I graduated from there in 1990, just as the Cold War was ending, just as the Berlin Wall was falling. Fast forward to today, where I've been teaching speech writing and public speaking at CIPA for the past 7 years. Today, instead of the Cold War ending, it seems something else might be ending. The world's post-World War II consensus itself may be in danger. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So, Guy, in homage to your book, I'm going to do this in tri-colon style, yes, with no harm to cats whatsoever. If you haven't read his book, read it. Nice plug. And address my topic today in three parts, okay? The state of the world today, why we need to act, and what we as speechwriters can do. And James, where's James? I'm going to tell a few stories, so listen along. Here goes. Let me start with my first story. Last week, I was invited to speak at Columbia's Obama Foundation Scholars about speechwriting and public speaking. That's me in the middle, the middle-aged guy there. These are some really talented individuals from around the world getting leadership training from my university. Smart kids, heady stuff. I started my presentation with a simple question. Can a speech ignite your career? These are Obama scholars, they're really smart. He says, of course I can. We all know who, right? Yes, I played a short clip from this 2004 video. Let's take a listen.
Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us. The spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There is the United States of America.
Okay. We all remember that speech, right? Raise your hand if you remember it. Okay, great. Obama was just a state senator back then. But that speech put him on the map. And the rest, as they say, is history. Now, I'm all for encouraging the next generation, and I didn't have the courage or the heart to show the next speech from just a few weeks ago, but I'll show it here.
Here's the stage. I've never seen this stupid stage. I've never seen it. But if I walk left, there's a stair. And if I walk right, there's a stair. And this guy gets up. Where am I? Nah, he's terrible.
Now, yeah, you can laugh, as you found out from my question. That was September, and I had a lot of material to work with. So, question, in the relatively short space of historically about 20 years, how did we go? How did we go from the soaring rhetoric of hope to the souring rhetoric of scorn? How indeed? Now, when asking questions like this, one of my bosses at Siemens used to tell me to ask the Toyota five whys. Right, what are the five whys? Ask why five times to start getting at the root cause of the issue. So let's try it. One, why is the person in that video, the front runner for the nomination of his party, even as he might be running from prison? Answer, because he's hugely popular with a significant portion of his own party. We heard that today. Two, why is he so popular? Because they feel he represents their interests better than anyone else has to date. He might be a bully. Is this working? He might be a bully, but he's my bully. Three, why? Because many voters feel abandoned by both parties, center left and center right, Democrats and Republicans. Four, why do they feel abandoned? Because they believe the major parties are basically the same and out of ideas. They've seen no material improvement in their lives, and they're pessimistic about the future. Five, why the anger? And this is just my opinion. Because they feel that they've played by the rules, but they haven't been listened to. Others have cut in line, and they seethe. Now, I'm not here to blame one party or the other, in my country or yours. I think there's plenty of blame to go around. So let me play this non-political video, which I think neatly captures today's zeitgeist. Take a look.
The one on the left is the one who gets cucumber. The one on the right is the one who gets grapes. The one who gets cucumber, note that the first piece of cucumber is perfectly fine. The first piece he eats. Then she sees the other one getting grape, and you will see what happens. So she gives a rock to us, that's the task. And we give her a piece of cucumber and she eats it. The other one needs to give a rock to us. And that's what she does. And she gets a grape. And she eats it. The other one sees that. She gives a rock to us now, gets again cucumber.
Okay, you notice I didn't target one party or another. This seems to be universal, right? I think it's true in the United States, I think it's true in the Netherlands, I think it's true in Europe, I think it's true all over the world. Very funny, but it captures a certain truth. When you feel the deck is stacked against you, all bets are off. You get mad, you turn, sorry.
You can't hold the lower part, so just keep
guessing. Okay, you get mad, sorry. I write speeches, I don't deliver them. Anyway, thank you. Okay, when you feel the deck is stacked against you, all bets are off. You turn to populists to channel your anger. We see this everywhere. In the US, we see it with those vocally supporting a former president, currently facing 91 felony charges in four courts. And he may yet win the nomination of his party. He may yet win the presidency again. We see it clearly with Brexit in the UK. We see it in Germany, where Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD, is now outpolling the Social Democrats, the Greens, and the Free Democrats. We see it in the rhetoric of those in power, and we see it in the rhetoric of those who seek power still. Orban, Erdogan, Le Pen, Wilders, Salvini. Headlines everywhere, democracy and globalization are in danger. Big danger. And we're not just talking about the coming post-Cold War era. We're talking about a possible post-World War II consensus era. That's a much bigger development. Which leads me to my second section. Why? We need to act. I personally think it's self-evident that we need to act, to pitch in. I took the title of my speech from a book called The End of the World is Just the Beginning, Mapping the Collapse of Globalization by global strategist Peter Zahan. It's from the United States. I won't kid you, it's a pretty dark book, but it's based on facts. He envisions a world where a deadly combination of demographics, geography, and history lethally combine to unravel our post-World War II global consensus. The result? A move to regional economic blocks that may rely less on open market trade and more on closed market survival. Think autarky, but not quite. You know all those Hollywood movie trailers with a deep baritone that says, imagine a world where, right? You know, we all know that, right? Well, imagine a world where the U.S. withdraws from its global role. Imagine a world where the U.S. Navy no longer ensures that the world's shipping lanes are safe for global trade. Not likely to happen, but what if a certain person is elected? What if he decides he doesn't want the U.S. to be the world's policeman anymore? Could happen. Imagine a world where supply chains become reshored. That's a real word, by the way. Unlikely? Guess again. Mexico is already planning to replace China as the manufacturer for the U.S. market. You don't believe it? It's already an issue in the Mexican presidential campaign. I know personally. Imagine a world, I'll talk later about that. Imagine a world where Europe's shrinking demographics, migration crisis, over-reliance on unstable energy suppliers, plus diminished trade with the U.S., Asia, and it just might be a perfect storm ahead. Oh, almost forgot. Sorry, guys. The climate crisis. The climate crisis to the economic impact of technologies like ChatGPT. And you'd be forgiven for giving that we're for thinking we're all living in a world like some kind of dark mirror episode. Right? Now, I'm not saying every scenario will come true. I don't mean to be totally pessimistic. I am American, after all. Right? But like a doctor making a diagnosis, it pays to consider even worst-case scenarios. It also pays to start thinking now about a cure. Which leads me to my third section. What can we, as speechwriters, do to help stem the tide? As I understand it, everyone here is a speechwriter or aspiring to be one, correct? I'm under no illusion that we wield real power to truly save democracy or make the world safe for a fairer form of globalization. We don't make policy, but we work with powerful people who do. Maybe we can help at the margins. How? By toning down the rhetoric at least a little bit. Let's go from boiling to at least a simmer, and by leading by example, guiding the conversation, remind people that there are better ways out there. Remind them of the old line. I couldn't figure out who said this, but bear with me. Watch your thoughts, they become your words. Watch your words, they become your actions. Watch your actions, they become habits. Watch your habits, they become character. Watch your character, because it becomes your destiny. So, how again? Now I'm going to violate my usual rule of three. Sorry, guy. Here's a longer list. I know, sorry. First, let's stop the us versus them mentality. Rigid identity politics is poisoning our marketplace of ideas. Urban versus rural, college educated versus non-university, one race against another. Stop. It's not Ajax versus Feyenoord. Is that right? Get it right? Okay. It can't be, I'm close enough, right? It can't be the EU, if it can't be the EU or the UN, okay, fine, then the national team, the Oranje. Is that right, too? Okay, the Oranje, right? Second, if you're going to talk about rights, you also need to talk about responsibilities. Grievance politics will only get you so far. It's not enough to talk about what society owes you. Talk about what you owe society. Thank you, John F. Kennedy. Ask where you're falling short. Where can you contribute to the greater good? And where can you make improvements? Third, and this is an important one. We see it today in my country. Be ready to criticize your own. Decades ago, US President Ronald Reagan talked about an 11th commandment. Thou shalt not say anything negative about a fellow Republican. Well, I'm sorry, Mr. President. I agree you are the great communicator, but that advice has not stood well over time. We see the consequences of America's divisive politics today. Fourth, don't vilify or ridicule those opposing you. Engage and persuade them instead. Ad hominem attacks rarely work. In fact, they usually trigger people to double down. Fifth, very important, get out of your bubble. Make a serious effort to talk to and understand people beyond your immediate circle. Talk to those who can't do much for you, but you quite possibly can do much for them. One of my favorite examples is this, from Klaus Kleinfeld, whom I wrote speeches for both in the US and Germany when he headed Siemens AG. Here he is at a school called Yale. It's a competitor of a small school. Anyway, listen to this.
We have, my office now is in New York, and I haven't been for a small headquarter on 80 people, and the rest is the first order on it. So sometimes they...
Can you...
I don't know what I can do to make it louder. I think it's already on maximum volume.
The thing here?
I think it's to put the speaker next to them.
Keep the microphone with the speaker.
I don't know where the speaker's coming from, where the sound's coming from.
We have, my office now is in New York Park Avenue. There is a small number of 80 people in the rest of the world all around the world. So the evening, and sometimes they're pretty late. When I'm there, I'm there pretty late the rest of the time. I'm traveling, you know. And when I'm there late, obviously at around 6:30 in the evening, the team comes in, right? And this is a team of people from Albania and Croatia, right? So and you know, I'm hanging around, they didn't know who I was, you know, so I'm hanging around, they wonder what is this to do about, you know. So and I can talk to them. I say, hey, where are you from? What are you doing here? You know, just talk the normal way when I'm going to the restaurant, when I walk into here, right? Okay, obviously over time they noticed who I was, right? And I think they were wondering, why is he like this? Why is he talking to us? And one evening, one of them, I had a good conversation in the restroom that he was just cleaning. So imagine the setting, you know. So the person says, you know what? I've heard this is very, very kind of you. I mean that you talk so openly and have a good dialogue and I always enjoy it. You know, when you're poor, people look through you. I thought that was amazing. An amazing discovery, right? And that's so true. People look through you. They don't see you, even though you are there. Why am I telling you this story? There's, on the value side, there's nothing, absolutely nothing, that justifies for you not to show respect to any individual as a man. No matter where the person is. And if you give that principle out, I mean you will want to not win life. Your life might look to someone who writes about it as great and fulfilled, but in the end, I mean that it's not a matter of good job yourself.
Yep, good. Thank you. Thank you. You feel it right? Right. Yay. Feels a little exercise in this class today. Okay. So they look through you. That's the key line there. Let's not make people invisible. Let's give them agency through our speeches. Let's tell their stories through the people we work for. Let's hear their concerns and make policies that address their concerns first and foremost, and watch the populace drop by the wayside, one hopes. Now, I know none of this is going to be easy, especially in our postmodernist age where snarky, sardonic, snide comments tend to get the most likes. I get it. But let me ask you this. What choice do we have? Surrender? Let the loudest voice in the room dominate? Or try to recapture the middle, where, by the way, most voters are? Try to make the middle exciting again. It's happened before, it can happen again. As former First Lady Michelle Obama once said, when they go low,
we go high.
We go high. Bingo. Okay. Words can become destiny. Let's take the high road. So finally, let me close by coming full circle. I told you I graduated just as the Cold War was ending. My school has a tradition of concluding the year with a comedy show we call the Seep of Follies. I volunteered to be a comedy writer in the 1990 show. Big surprise, right? Writing. All right. Now, my close-off music today then was REM's It's the End of the World as We Know It. Raise your hand if you know okay, great. Oh, good. So I wasn't sure. All right. Perhaps a perfect choice at the time, and perhaps an even more perfect, if I can say that, choice today. So here is my walk-off music. In 2023, it's the end of the world as we know it. I don't necessarily feel fine, but I am going to ask you, I am going to do my best, at least rhetorically, and make the world a better place. I hope you do too. Thank you. Thank you.
I feel like you can hear the music a bit.
It's a great song.
do you want to take questions then?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to take questions.
Assuming you guys have questions, we've got a bit of time.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. Klaus was already working at Alcoa, and I wasn't his speechwriter at that time. He gave a speech at the Yale Business School, and he tends to talk a lot on values. And I thought that this was one of the best anecdotes he had, talking about, I hope you all heard it. It was the cleaning crew. They didn't know who he was, and they was talking. And then they said, when you're poor, people look through you. You're invisible. And they asked him, why are you this way? Because this is the way I always am. And this is the way we all should be, right? I mean, 2 days ago, I made friends with a guy named Wilson. He's the one who does the scrambled, the scrambled eggs. He's from Suriname. He worked in a gold mine. And he knew my wife is from Taiwan, so he started saying some stuff in Chinese to me, but I don't speak Mandarin. But he said, there were Chinese workers in that gold mine. I'm like, listen to people, hear their stories. He's not in this room right now with us, but hear their stories. It's important. I think this is part of the problem. I think too many of the centrist parties, I don't care what country, have been ignoring these people. And when people feel ignored, they look to populist solutions. They look to populist politicians to give them agency, to give them voice. I think we in the center particularly need to start listening a little bit more carefully. And again, I'm under no illusions. This is not going to be easy. But what do you suggest, right? What alternative is there, right? Any other questions? Yes.
You said don't vilify your opponent.
Yes.
I got the idea that you don't.
He said don't vilify your opponents.
Yeah. I got the idea that you didn't particularly like Mr. Trump. Is that also?
How did you get that impression?
No, it's difficult, right? If you dislike someone that much, how do you remain disciplined?
Okay. Trump is a big, big boy, and he's a politician, okay? I don't vilify the people who support him because I think they support him for specific reasons. I think the problem is when you vilify the supporters, you're making it absolutely impossible to have a conversation with them. I mean, ask the five whys. Why are you supporting Donald Trump? It isn't because of his hairstyle. I mean, it's because he's channeling anger. Why the anger? And on and on and on. And then address that anger. I'll give you one example that blew me away. I never thought about it. I said, why do you like Donald Trump? Well, he says what's on my mind. Well, why? I said, well, I had a lawn cutting business. And when the US signed NAFTA, the NAFTA was the agreement among Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Well, once we had NAFTA, right, my lawn care business got undercut because competitors could bring in illegal Mexican labor and pay less money. And I got out. I never heard of that issue before. But I never heard of it because I hadn't engaged that person in a conversation before. Now I did. Now I know why he's angry. It's not necessarily that he's in love with Donald Trump. He's pissed. You say pissed is different in British English, but he's pissed off. And he's using Trump as a almost channel for that anger. But if you understand what issues are impacting that person, then maybe you can make policy that helps make his life a little bit better, right? But again, I didn't even occur to me for that issue, because I was in D.C. in 1992. I worked at the DNC for the re-election campaign in 96, and NAFTA was going to be this wonderful thing. Yeah, for some people, for some companies, but not for that person. But we have to hear that person, right? That's why focus groups are so important, right? Any other questions? No?
Well, you quoted Michelle Obama. You quoted Michelle Obama when they go low,
yes,
we go high. I've always been uneasy with that.
Why?
Because I associated with it. Obama at one time was in an Oreo factory, I think.
Was what?
The chocolate cookies.
And okay.
Like, do you eat this stuff? Things like that. He was in a totally different world.
Oh.
And somehow the Michelle Obama quote resonated that for me too. When they go low, we go high. I suggest you try and go low and confront what's happening there.
Yeah.
Fight it. And not just, I don't know, there's something unequal. Can you feel my pain? It's sort of a...
There is an
arrogance.
Yeah, patronized. Right. And
cookies.
Yeah, and there was actually a quote from him. He went to Pennsylvania, and part of Pennsylvania is pretty liberal, but part of it's deeply conservative in the West. And he said that they love their guns, they love their religion, et cetera, and boy, did that backfire on him, too.
Go ahead. But at the time, they were still very much Democratic.
Yeah.
And it's Obama, under Obama's rule, that yeah, they fucked up.
Fair point. No, I'm not doing hagiography here. I'm not saying he's perfect. And all politicians have their Achilles heel. I get it. But I still think we need a North Star, right? At least something to guide us away from this. Because the status quo now, if it continues, I don't know. And frankly, I'll say one last thing. I was at a discussion at my university actually a few days ago where we talked about, you think you have a law called DSA or some sort of Digital Security Act or something like that? Anyway, moderating online discussion. And the speaker basically said, the United States is the Wild West, China is on the other side, total control, and the Europeans are in the middle for moderating that. A lot of the social media platforms could dial it back a little bit so that we stop getting those dopamine hits that make us want to keep going and going and getting angrier and angrier. There are actually answers for it. And frankly, I think, congratulations to Europeans. I think you have the right model, we don't. This is my 2 cents. Sorry?
You don't have it anymore.
You don't have the DSA anymore?
No, you don't. The United States doesn't have it anymore.
No.
We were always for us some sort of glowing capital on the hill. But at this moment, I really think about the United States as a third world country.
In some ways, I agree.
Yeah.
So, that it?
Thank you.
Thank you.